become multi-million dollar commercial jingles. But the question is, who's getting paid and who's really getting played? Such a volatile minefield.
In this world of cold concrete and lifeless steel, there is no warmth here, no affection, no touch.
But more than the cacophonous conversation, I crave the pleasure of feeling myself. I need you to keep me sensitive.
Hear the Uhuru Sasa Poetry Share on Prison Pipeline, November 24th at 6:30 p.m.
Triumphantly, won't you help me sing this song of freedom?
Yes, that's right here on KBOO Portland. It's a half a minute past 11 a.m. and coming up, Disability Awareness is off today, but instead we'll hear an episode of Peace Talks Radio on Nonviolent Communication that will be featuring Marshall Rosenberg. This program was recorded at the First Church of Religious Science Auditorium in 2005, but it is still timely today. And we want to thank our KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Oh, pirates, yes, to my mind.
Hear poetry from the prisoners at the Oregon State Penitentiary.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
This is Peace Talks, a special radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies. So much conflict arises from the habitual ways we've been taught to think and speak.
Thomas, I've told you a million times to keep this living room clean. You make me crazy.
Communication styles that seem commonplace often cause anger and pain and can lead to violence.
He screams across the table, "You people are murderers!" One of them screams back, "Then why did you kill my son if you don't want murder?"
Today we'll hear another approach from Marshall Rosenberg, founder and director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication.
Finally, I got both sides just to hear each other's needs, and then one of the chiefs that hadn't spoken yet jumped up. The chief said, "If we know how to communicate this way, we don't have to kill each other."
From the family room to the highest level peace negotiation, stay tuned to learn how nonviolent communication techniques might reduce conflict and improve relationships. Today on Peace Talks.
You're the most self-centered person I've ever met.
You have no right to say that. I am always considering your needs. You're the one who's really self-centered.
You know what you need? You need some therapy. That's what you need.
You need to chill out.
That's another thing. You're always telling me what to do and to chill out when you're the one making me angry.
Linda and Scott here are acting out a conflict that probably sounds familiar to many of us. At one time or another, we've all either witnessed or participated in heated speech that seems just a short step away from physical violence. And even if it doesn't reach that step, our words are sometimes loaded with judgment and demands that seem only to breed more resentment and conflict. Do the ways we've learned to think and speak actually block communication, cause pain and further misunderstanding, and lead to violence? I'm Paul Ingalls, along with Suzanne Kreider. This is Peace Talks, the series exploring peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. We're speaking to you today from an auditorium in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where an audience has gathered to listen to and take part in our conversation with Dr. Marshall B. Rosenberg, the author of Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life. As a clinical psychologist, mediator, and communication skills trainer, Dr. Rosenberg has been shaping the Nonviolent Communication Model, or NVC for short, for about 40 years. He founded the Center for Nonviolent Communication in 1984 and is with us at an auditorium in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to talk about his work and how he feels it can help us build better relationships and be used to diffuse conflict in many environments. Marshall Rosenberg, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You begin your book with the story of your family moving to Detroit and as a child almost immediately witnessing racial conflicts. As a youngster, you were harassed and beaten by bullies because of your Jewish ethnicity. Over the years now, you've developed this method that we're about to detail, nonviolent communication. To get to this method, though, you've spent a lot of time observing our typical communication habits and thinking about societal structures that you say disconnect us from our compassionate nature.
Well, we've been living under structures that require educating people to believe that authority knows what's right for us to do, and that it's our job to do what authority tells us to do, and that if we don't, we deserve to be punished for that. If we do what authority says, we deserve to be rewarded. Now, that's a dangerous way to teach people, because there's a lot of people who claim to be authorities and know what's right and have a lot of power and can educate people to do things that I think are rather violent, like look at other people as enemies, and we can be educated to think that we have to punish them because the authorities tell us these people are bad. So that kind of thinking is, for me, very dangerous, and I wanted to do what I could to show people another way of thinking and communicating that I think is more natural and more conducive to everybody getting their needs met peacefully.
So, Marshall, you suggest that the NVC process you've outlined removes a lot of this propensity towards violence. Why don't you just start by going over the four steps in the NVC process?
Well, the four steps are basically two steps. The process is designed to help us answer two questions. What's alive in us? What's alive in us? Now, that's not new. Every culture I work in, and I work with many throughout the world, when they get together, the first thing they ask is, what's alive in you? They don't say those words in English-speaking countries. They say it this way, how are you? French-speaking countries, comment allez-vous? Spanish, como está usted? Rwanda, amakuru. It's a natural question to care about how people are. So nonviolent communication says, let's learn how to be honest about how we are. Not tell each other what we think the other person is, how we are. So that's one of the central questions of nonviolent communication. The other central question is, what would make life more wonderful? So nonviolent communication tries to connect us in a way with other people so that they see what's alive in us and what would make life more wonderful. And we can see what's alive in them and what would make life more wonderful for them. And my experience has been when people can connect at that level, whatever the conflict, they can find ways of resolving it in which everybody's needs get met peacefully, where people give to one another from the heart, willingly. Now, the four steps that you mentioned, there's four pieces of information that we need to know how to exchange in order to make it clear to people what's alive in us and what would make life more wonderful.
And break it down. What are the steps that make it alive and what are the steps that refer to wonderful?
First of all, to tell people specifically what they're doing that is or is not contributing to our well-being, and to be very specific about that, not to mix in any diagnosis or any analysis. We call that a clear observation.
The observation step, right.
And then, once we've done that, we're honest with people, but we're honest with them from the heart by telling them what's alive in us when they do that. And that, more specifically, is how we feel, what emotions we feel, and we connect our feelings to our needs. And then we follow that up with the other question, what would make life more wonderful? And we answer that with a very clear request, not using any fuzzy language, but exactly what would we like back from that person at this moment in response to what we have said, in response to the fact that some of our needs are not getting met by their behavior.
We're happy to have actors Linda Rodeck and Scott Shiro here with us today, who are occasionally going to give voice to some of these concepts and role play some with Marshall. Linda's going to give us a brief before and after demonstration of NVC to get us started here. This is right from Marshall's book. So here's the before scene. Linda, as a frustrated mom of a teenager.
Thomas, I've told you a million times to keep this living room clean. You make me crazy. pick up all these sacks now or you're not getting to use the car tonight.
Okay, so Marshall, let's start with the before shot here. I'm guessing that this approach sounds pretty familiar to listeners who would say, some of them, that, well, there's a firm threat of punishment there. It may accomplish the goal of getting the socks picked up. What's wrong with the picture, though?
Well, what's wrong with the picture is that it looks like the mother has single-mindedness of purpose to get the son to do what she wants. And whenever we have single-mindedness of purpose, it's our objective to get what we want, it leaves the other person with the impression that what's alive in them doesn't matter. And when people believe that, they don't enjoy doing what we're asking them to do, even if it's something they would generally enjoy doing. And so they're more likely then to resist doing it or do it with an energy we'll pay for.
Okay, so from Marshall's book now, another option, same scenario, frustrated mom with the teenager, this time using NVC.
Thomas, when I see two balls of dirty socks under the coffee table and another three next to the TV, well, I feel irritated because I'm needing more order in the rooms that we share in common. Would you be willing to put your socks in your room or in the washing machine?
So how do the components work here to make this more effective in your view?
She did say what she observed. She said her feeling and needs and made a clear request. She used the mechanics perfectly. But many people use the mechanics hoping that it'll be a way of getting what they want. Because one of the hardest things for people to give up in using nonviolent communication is the objective of winning, getting what you want. Now, when I say that, many people think then I'm suggesting you be a chump and just give up your needs and give in. No, not at all. The objective is to create the quality of connection that will get everybody's needs met. But that means we cannot be addicted to getting our request fulfilled by the other person. It means we're more interested in the quality of connection than in any specific result.
Let's take a few minutes on each of the four steps, and we'll start with observation. What do you find are the biggest challenges for folks in learning how to state observation?
The biggest challenge is that we have been taught to think in a way that makes it hard to be specific about what we're observing.
We're going to ask Linda and Scott to step up to the mic again, and we're going to try role-playing one of Marshall's encounters that he wrote about in his book, working with the faculty of an elementary school that was having communication problems with the principal.
So I'd like to know one thing the principal does. We're going to talk with him next week. So before that, I'd like to understand, what's one thing that he does that's not in harmony with your needs?
Well, he has a big mouth.
Excuse me, but I wasn't asking the size of his mouth. I was asking one specific thing he does that you don't like.
I know what he means. The principal talks too much.
Excuse me, but too much is your evaluation. You see, that implies that there's a right way to talk and a wrong way and too much and too little. I'm asking not for your evaluation of how much he talks, but what he does.
Well, he thinks that only he has something worth saying.
Telling me what he thinks is another analysis. It might be an accurate analysis, but it's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, what does he do? And you're telling me what you think he thinks.
Well, he wants to be the center of attention all the time.
That also might be true. That might be an accurate diagnosis, but that's a diagnosis of his motives. I'm asking what he does, not what his motives are.
Well, your question's hard to answer.
It's very hard to answer. The philosopher Jaddu Krishnamurti says the highest form of human intelligence is the ability to observe without evaluating.
Okay, thank you. So here the teachers are having trouble separating their judgments from identifying specific behaviors that aren't meeting their needs.
Yes.
And until they do, they can't even start to address the conflict with the principal.
If they have those thoughts in their head that they did, all those diagnoses, that he has a big mouth, that he wants to be the center of attention, all of those imply wrongness, that you shouldn't be that way. And even if we don't say such thinking out loud, if we're even thinking that way about somebody else, we lose power.
So do you recall how this situation worked out? This was a real-life story, wasn't it?
Oh, I recall very well. With my help, it wasn't easy. Finally, they got clear with the answer to my question of what does he do, and it was this, that during their faculty meetings, no matter what the agenda item was, he would start to tell stories of his war experiences and childhood experiences. So the average meeting lasted about 20 minutes longer than, was scheduled. And so the plan was, would come to the next faculty meeting, and they would like my support in talking with him about this. So I got to the meeting, and I could see very quickly what they were talking about. No matter what was being said, he would jump in and say, oh, that reminds me of a time, and then he'd start to tell one of his stories. And I was waiting for one of the teachers to confront him in the way that we had practiced. But instead of saying anything, they were giving a lot of nonverbal messages. They were, you know, rolling their eyes, poking the person next to them, yawning, looking at their watches, holding the watches up to their ears. Finally, I said, excuse me, but isn't somebody going to say something? And then a silence, and one of the teachers looked at the administrator and said, Ed, you have a big mouth. So much for my teaching ability.
Is there a happy ending?
The happy ending is that, yes, I cleaned up the mess, and I helped them to make clear what the observation was, and helped him, the administrator, to see their feelings and needs. And then they heard his, why he was doing this. And yes, I liked how it ended.
For folks who don't have the benefit of having you there to give feedback on their observations, what are some specific tips on how we can debrief ourselves? Like, how can you make your observations clearer?
Well, we can make the observations clearer by asking ourselves, is there any way that a person would hear this as a criticism or an insult? Because any time we use words that are heard by other people as a criticism, blame, if we saw how much we pay for that, we would never use such language.
This is Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. I'm Paul Ingalls with Suzanne Kreider. We're talking with Marshall Rosenberg, founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. So moving on to the second component of the nonviolent communication model, expressing feelings. We've observed something. How do you recommend we recognize and name the feeling that the observed behavior is bringing up in us?
Well, the main thing is to differentiate it from thoughts, to not mix up feelings and thoughts. For example, if after the word feel, we start to say, I feel that, we can tell already it's not going to be a feeling. That's going to be a thought. I feel like, same problem. I feel you. I feel I. None of those are going to be feelings. Those are going to be thoughts. So a feeling is an emotion. We feel it in our body. So it's feelings like when our needs are being fulfilled, we feel pleasureful feelings like happy, delighted. We feel peaceful. Those are feelings. But we don't feel that what you did was right. That's a thought.
And in your book, you talk about how there are certain environments where people feel that feelings are inappropriate. Like people don't do feelings at work, or people don't do feelings.
In my culture, certainly if you're a man, you don't have certain feelings. If you're a man, you don't feel frightened ever. You don't feel hurt ever. You can feel angry. That's okay. So to remind myself of this, I keep a picture of John Wayne in my office. He's got 6 arrows in him. And he says, it only hurts when I laugh.
What do you recommend for helping people develop emotional fluency?
Well, I hope that they get some of the experience that I did by hearing the people around me tell me how painful it was for them never to be able to connect with my feelings. So if we could really see and people give us feedback about how much it changes the relationship and makes it safe for them to be able to connect with what's alive in us, I think we would do great efforts to get beyond this cultural stereotyping. But I went to schools for 21 years and nobody ever asked me what I was feeling. See, the schools that I went to oriented your consciousness to getting good grades from the teacher. So you were all focused on what does the teacher think is right. So your whole consciousness is oriented outward to how you're being judged by others. And in that way, you become a nice, dead person.
So would you recommend people, if they're having trouble finding a safe place for their feelings at the workplace, for example, would you recommend that they sit down with a supervisor and say, I need this, and let me explain why?
Oh, I would hope that people do it in any relationship, in their families, in the workplace. But we need to do it with the awareness that speaking a language of life is often not what other people are used to. So we not only teach people how to speak a language of life, but how to enjoy other people when they freak out.
How do you do that, by the way?
Well, I'll give you an example. I was working in a corporate setting once with some executives and all very serious. You know, it's not an environment that you heard many feelings. And I had just finished working with their wives. This corporation, for various reasons, asked me to first work with the wives and then with the executives. And the wives were telling me how sad it was for them that the husbands were all day in this environment that didn't support human feelings being expressed. And that would be okay if when they came home they could switch, but the husbands came home and they never were expressing in a way that they felt they could connect. So when I was sitting in the room with these executives, I saw what the wives were living with. They were sitting there, and it's hard to know what was going on in them. And I can't remember what the trigger was. I got so emotional that I started to cry. Oh, my goodness. Now, in that setting, that's not what you do if you're a man, and especially if you are the workshop leader. And so I got the worst response I could have gotten, the most that would challenge my ability in nonviolent communication. I got this response from everybody except the boss. They looked at me like I had thrown a rat in the punch bowl. Now, the boss's reaction was even more trying. He just looked away from me, you know, as though, you know, he couldn't believe that anyone would cry in such a meeting. Fortunately, I was able to do what we teach in nonviolent communication, and that is to connect with what's alive in people, no matter what their message, even if it's a nonverbal message like that. And I turned to the boss and I said, "Are you feeling disgusted when you see me crying because you have a need for men to be more in control of themselves?" Now, if he says yes, what's the problem with that? I don't hear any criticism. I just hear that as his feelings and needs. But I wasn't prepared for his response, because instead of what I expected, he said, no, I'm not disgusted. I was just thinking how my wife wishes I could cry. I'm going through a divorce right now. This is the reason. She says, living with me is like living with a rock. Now, you see, if I hadn't checked out what was going on in him, you see, if I had just, on the basis of all of their looks, said to myself, "Oh, my goodness, I should have known better. You can't express your feelings in this setting." You know, I would have walked away thinking that I had to keep my feelings to myself. So, no, I would hope in any environment we share that which is alive in us. And then be aware, though, that culturally some people might not be used to it. Some people might have some harsh judgments of it. But if we hear the feelings and needs that are alive in the person at this moment, it's a gift. It's a gift.
In the next chapter of your book, you suggest something that's a hard concept to master, that other people don't cause our feelings. I think anyone who's ever heard a father say, "Look, you made your mother cry," is doomed to believe that someone else's behavior can cause feelings in someone else.
One of the things I liked about where I lived in Detroit, we had a reminder to each other from the time we were 6 years old on, not to get caught in those guilt games that adults play. We had some beautiful poetry we would recite. Somebody would call us a name, for example, trying to hurt our feelings. And we would say, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me." So we were aware of that then, that, you know, how other people responded to us couldn't make us feel anything. It's how we took it. But we lost that the more we fell under this guilt tactics of parents who want us to feel that we were responsible for their feelings, who want us to do things and do it this way. "It hurts me when you don't clean up the dishes." You see, and if we believe that, then we end up doing things out of guilt. So to avoid that game, we make everybody aware other people can't make you feel anything. All people have to do is follow me around in my work for a while, and they'll really see this powerfully. I can be working in a place like Rwanda with people, everyone in a room that's had one or more of their family members killed. And some of them are so angry, all they can do is live for vengeance. Others have had the same things happen. They don't have anger. They have strong feelings, but not anger. And their feelings lead them to want to prevent this ever happening to anybody again. So not even something like having your family killed can make you feel angry. It's how we take it.
You go on to talking about how, having established that how you're feeling about a given communication, to linking that feeling with the need that's not being met.
Yes.
And this is really a critical step. Why is it so hard, do you think?
Because we have been educated for a long time to fit within domination structures, to do what authority says. And when you want people to be nice, dead people and do what authority says, the last thing you want them to be conscious of is the life within them. You can't make a good slave out of somebody who's fully alive. So the last thing you want to teach people, if you want a domination structure, is to be in touch with their needs. You want to teach them that the highest value is not a need to express your needs. Needs means you're needy, selfish, dependent, egotistical. Loving women have no needs. They suppress their needs for their family. Brave men have no needs. They're willing to lose their lives for the king. So that's why we don't know what our needs are. Again, I went to schools for 21 years. Not only was I never asked what I was feeling, I certainly was never asked what my needs were.
And give us a list of maybe the top 5 or 7 generic human needs.
Let me give you all 9 of them, because according to the Chilean economist, Manfred Max Neef, we only have about 9 needs. And needs are very important to Max Neef because his whole economic system is based on human needs. And how do we measure them so we can really gauge our economy, its success, on the meeting of human needs and not the tragic way we've been measuring it? The first one he calls sustenance, food, shelter, water, the basic physical needs. Next, safety, protection. Next, love. Next, understanding. Next, community, a warm community. Next, recreation, play, rest. He lumps those as one. And then, one of the most important needs of all, autonomy. See, look in the newspaper on any given day and see how many wars are going on over that need. Human beings have a strong need to be in charge of their own lives, to not have somebody else claiming to know what they have to do, should do. Anybody that says that to them, it threatens their autonomy. So you see all the wars going on between nations. But listen in on any family with children, you'll hear autonomy wars. Parent, it's time to go and wash, you know, up for bed. No, I don't want to. Did you hear me? No. See, an autonomy war. Another need, a need for creativity. And then, according to Viktor Frankl, probably the most important need of all, a need for meaning. Purpose in life, you see. How sad how few people on the planet are getting that need met. They're educated to misrepresent needs, according to Michael Lerner. We've been educated to misrepresent our needs. So we've been educated to think we have a need to consume, a need for money, a need for status, not realizing those are not needs.
So in mapping out the 4 components of the nonviolent communication model, we've said a little bit more about observation without judgment, expressing the feeling, connecting it with our needs, and now step 4, the request. It's the step that can actually bring some change, but you say we either tend to leave it out or aren't very clear about it. Can you elaborate for us on that?
There's 2 things that is very important to learn at this step. First, yes, how to make clear requests. That means making sure you say to the other person what you want them to do rather than just what you want them to stop doing. For example, a teacher, when I brought this up recently, said, "Oh boy, Marshall, you helped me understand what happened yesterday. I told this one boy who was tapping on his book while I was talking." She said, "I don't want you to tap on that book while I'm talking." So he tapped on his desk. We need to say what we do want, not simply what we don't want. And then we need to use very clear language. We can't say, "I want you to understand." What does that mean? How do we know whether the person has understood or not? "I want you to love me." Too vague. We have to be much more specific. What actions do you want the person to take? So it's not easy for people to do that. They don't know how to be that clear about what they want, and that's one of the main reasons they don't get their needs met.
You're listening to Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. I'm Paul Ingalls with Suzanne Kreider. After a break, we'll take some questions from our studio audience, and we continue with Marshall Rosenberg, founder and educational director of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. You're listening to Peace Talks, the radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent solutions to conflict. I'm Paul Ingalls with Suzanne Kreider, and our guest today is Dr. Marshall Rosenberg, Ph.D. in clinical psychology and the founder of the Center for Nonviolent Communication, also the author of the book Nonviolent Communication, A Language for Life. We've outlined the four components of what's known as the NVC model: observation, feeling, need, and request. And let's take some questions from our audience here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm Geraldine. I have a question about whether there are situations in which, no matter how well expressed your need is, that it still can't be met, either because the other person that you're, the person you're dealing with, doesn't really want to meet the need, or because there are conflicting needs in the situation. One example of that might be that the scenario with the mother with the son who is leaving his dirty socks all over there. I can imagine that she might express her need perfectly well in terms of identifying the problem and saying what she needs. Her son may feel that he has a certain kind of need for an autonomy that doesn't allow him to do what she's asking. And then she, you know, I assume she also has a need not to spend her time picking up her son's dirty socks. So what about those kind of situations?
I've never seen a situation where if both people hear each other's needs, we can't find a way of getting everybody's needs met. The biggest problem is people mistake needs with strategies. So they, for example, a husband and wife said to me,